On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
So, Sergeant of Arms reported to me that they have been unable to locate any state senators.
Last Thursday, the president of the Oregon State Senate looked exhausted. He just called a session to order when he realized all of the Republicans had simply refused to show up.
"We are two senators short of being able to do any business on the floor of the Oregon State Senate."
He announced he'd be sending state police after the missing senators, that he'd be fining them $500 for every day they missed. And then he gave one of the strangest speeches I have ever heard an elected official deliver.
"I beg and beseech my fellow legislators to come to the floor. I need you. The legislature needs you. The people of Oregon need you."
He's shaking his head like a rejected suitor at this point. It looks like he could cry.
"If you're mad and you're angry, upset, take it out on me. Say things about me. Come at me. Don't do this to people of Oregon. Don't do this to this branch. You're too good. You've been chosen. I'm begging you to come back. I don't want to send the state police. Are you? I have no other choice. I have no other choice."
While this speech was going on, Senate Republicans were on their way out of state, and their tone was giddy.
"Okay, so sending the threat out like, oh, we're going to have a special session or I'm going to send the state police to arrest you. Well, I'm quotable. So here's the quote. This is what I told the superintendent. Send bachelors and come heavily armed. I'm not going to be a political prisoner in the state of Oregon. It's just that simple."
I think that particular comment was really what lit a torch to this whole situation.
Jason Wilson reports for The Guardian. He moved here from Australia, but he's lived in Oregon for the last 5 years. He says this Republican glee has animated so much of what happened next.
"That's what really, I think, got the Democrats hopping mad. And that's what attracted the interest of the national media, which also amped everything up significantly."
What drove the Republicans out of town was this climate bill, a cap and trade agreement that would have severely restricted greenhouse gas emissions. Republicans didn't want to give it a vote because they knew they'd lose.
"A lot of it is Republicans signaling to their constituents and importantly to their donors that they are not going to compromise on any effort to address climate change. This is the hill that they're prepared to die on, I guess is the best way of putting it."
But it's not just the climate change bill at stake. With the legislative session nearly over, there are more than 100 other bills in jeopardy. Bills that would fund Medicaid and establish paid family leave. In Oregon, the clock is ticking, and the legislature is waiting. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next. Stay with us.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
As of the time we put this show together, the missing Republicans were still missing. And that exhaustion you heard in the voice of Oregon's Senate president, it's only gotten more profound as the days have passed. Eventually, he caved to the pressure.
We do not have a quorum, so we cannot proceed to our agenda.
Earlier this week, he got up on the floor of the Senate and announced that cap and trade bill, it's called HB 20. It was off.
What I'm about to say, I say of my own free will. No one has told me to say this. There is no strategy what I'm about to say. It's just Peter. House Bill 2020 does not have the votes on the Senate floor. That will not change.
I asked Jason, what happened here?
He was kind of saying, well, even with us Democrats, we don't actually have solid numbers for this bill. So he appeared to be saying that there were three Democrats who weren't going to vote for it anyway. So why hold up everything else for this bill?
And it felt like he was a hostage or something. He was like, I'm saying this of my own free will. It was very strange.
It was odd. He was kind of throwing his hands up and saying, you know, we've got other business here that we need to attend to, that we want to attend to. And you know, it was interpreted as a sort of surrender to this Republican brinksmanship. Obviously, at one level, it was.
And I saw this picture from when this happened. These protesters who were in the gallery when this happened, people in favor of this cap and trade legislation, and they all just turned their back on him, right?
Yeah. And you know, like the Democrats are absolutely burning bridges here with the climate movement, which in a liberal state like Oregon, you know, it's a significant movement. This is a whole bunch of NGOs and individuals who have really invested a lot in the idea of this bill passing.
I guess the big question now is whether the Republicans come back, because there have been some people saying, well, this could be a Democratic ploy to get us back. And then, surprise, we're voting on cap and trade, right?
I mean, that would be a level of tactical acumen that the Democrats haven't displayed so far. But, but you know, I mean, that discussion really displaces the more important one, I think, which is what the heck are these guys doing, absconding to Idaho in order to not do their jobs as senators? I mean, I feel like that conversation has been slightly lost in the drama of will they come back or won't they?
What would happen if the Republicans stayed away through the end of the session?
Well, the Senate would not be able to pass anything. The Senate would not be able to vote on anything.
And then what?
That's it. You know, everything gets put off until next year or abandoned altogether.
Does that mean police don't get paid? Does that mean teachers don't get a raise? What does that mean?
Well, I haven't been through all 100 bills that are pending, but yeah, I mean, it will mean that state employees don't get paid or that state employees aren't able to do their jobs for other reasons. It will mean that basic functions of the state government will not be able to go on. And for them to just sort of completely abandon that whole process would be unprecedented, as I understand it, in Oregon history. Like, for them to just stay away for the rest of the session and to refuse to allow the Democrats to kind of vote on anything. You know, I mean, failed state is a big word, but failed legislature probably is appropriate.
In Oregon, Democrats have control over both the assembly and the governor's mansion. But not showing up gave the Republicans newfound power. Even after the Dems declared that their climate change bill was dead, the GOP kept the Senate waiting, wondering if taking cap and trade off the table would lure the missing senators back to work. It didn't. Let's talk about this bill in particular, because it's a cap and trade measure. It's been hard to pass these in the Pacific Northwest, but just in general, California has a bill that does something like what this bill does. Can you explain a little bit how it would work?
Yeah, so it caps the amount of carbon emissions that can be released in the state. So it caps the amount of fossil fuels that can, in particular that can be used. And over time, that cap is reduced. Now,
yeah, I liked the kind of musical chairs aspect of it, where it regulates all the industries and then eventually, you know, fewer and fewer of the offsets are available. So it forces people to emit less.
Right. All the while, people are able to trade, you know, the permits that they receive for carbon emissions. So really, it's a way of creating a kind of market-based incentive for people to, or for firms, for businesses, to reduce their carbon emissions.
And my impression is that part of what made this bill so important was that it regulates everyone. It wasn't just one industry, it was a lot of them. And so it would hit a lot of different people. And Oregon has logging interests and other businesses that would be impacted. And people were also worried about gas prices.
Right. Most people think about Oregon and they probably think about Portland and maybe some mountains. But, you know, really outside the urban areas where, you know, there's a lot of employment in tech. Nike's here in Portland. You know, there are other sort of high tech or design based industries here. But really outside Portland and Salem and Eugene, in rural areas, Oregon really still is a kind of extractive resource-based economy. So yeah, there's a lot of logging. There is some mining, but logging is a big deal. And those rural areas over the last 30 or 40 years have gone from being quite prosperous as a result of logging to, you know, being not so prosperous at all. And that's kind of visible when you visit a lot of rural Oregon towns.
I read about rural Oregonians protesting this bill outside of the legislature. I'm not sure how many of them there were, but I did hear, you know, loggers were driving their trucks around the Capitol. And it did make me wonder, has Oregon been neglecting those rural areas and sort of giving more support to the urban areas where a lot more people are making a lot more money?
Well, yeah, Oregon's a blue state. But that's only the case in its urban areas. The state's political divide really maps on pretty much exactly to that urban-rural divide. And rural areas elect Republicans, but not enough to really influence the direction of the state or to form a kind of governing majority. The politicians who absconded this week exclusively, I think, represent rural areas. And in those areas, yes, there's a lot of rural poverty in Oregon. A lot of the decline of those towns has not been addressed.
Did this bill do anything to address this?
Well, no, not directly. You know, I mean, look, there was a period where land management changed and rural towns in Oregon were kind of compensated by that for that by the federal government. But that avenue of compensation has run out. And you've got a situation in places like Josephine County and far Southern Oregon, where they had to close their public libraries a couple of years ago. There were cases where people couldn't get police out to their properties at night, you know, when a crime was taking place because the police weren't able to staff their dispatch. So it's a situation where there is a really significant economic divide as well between rural and urban areas in Oregon.
Feels like the Democrats need to fix that at the same time that they're fixing the climate change stuff.
Right, but their incentives are more to, you know, their own constituents. So it's a bit difficult. But yeah, I mean, I think there are absolutely criticisms that can be made of Democrats in Oregon and in the Pacific Northwest that they have allowed that situation to deteriorate far more than they should have.
It's interesting because I was looking at some of the language around this protest and what the Republicans were saying. And it felt like it shared something with the protests we'd seen earlier this year in France, the Yellow Vest protests, where rural French people had come out in far greater numbers And they had protested climate change legislation and they'd said some of the same things that were being said here about, you know, we're going to pay the costs of all this. We need to drive our cars. We can't take a train somewhere to do our jobs. And it struck me that progressives around the world need to think about these issues as they push their agendas forward.
Yeah, I think that's right. Not only progressives, but as you know, whatever your politics, as societies, we need to think about what a just transition to a less carbon intensive economy would look like. What are we going to do for the people whose jobs are wiped out, who are working in industries that are wiped out, whose communities are no longer kind of viable? You know, what are we saying to these people now? Are we saying you all need to move to Portland? How are people going to do that? How are they going to afford to do that? What skills do they have to offer an urban economy? I think also, like, these communities can't hold their young people either. And that's a real difficulty when you're trying to imagine a future for your community. If young people aren't sticking around, if there aren't jobs for them, if they can't live their lives in the same communities that their parents grew up in or their grandparents, what are you saying to those folks?
Of course, this Republican walkout isn't solving any of those problems either. And it's worth noting Democrats have tried this tactic too. Oregon's governor has called these Republican senators anti-democratic, but she herself fled the state to avoid negotiating when she was a senator.
Yes, in 2001, the Democrats did some quorum busting of their own, and that was over a redistricting issue. And yeah, I mean, it happens in other legislatures as well. Quorum busting, you know, is not something we've seen a lot of lately. And I think that's why this became such a big story. And also, yeah, them fleeing the state, going on the lam. I mean, what raises the stakes on this one is, you know, is this what the future looks like across the country as people try to address climate change? If Republicans in Oregon are prepared to blow up the legislature, I mean, what hope is there of passing even kind of moderate climate change measures in say, Texas or in other states where, you know, resource economies are also important?
Well, it's not just about the topic, although climate change is, of course, one of the most important topics right now for us to address. It's about the fact that all across the country, local legislatures are being dominated by single parties. I read this statistic that this is the first time in more than a century that so many state legislatures have been dominated by either a Democrat or a Republican party. It's creating these super majorities. And instead of making the minority quieter, it's making them louder. They're taking their toys and leaving. They're doing all kinds of things to try to just have some little bit of control.
Right. So it's an artifact of the polarization that just affects every aspect of our lives in this country. You know, and one thing maybe that the nation has found out over the last week or so is how deeply polarized Oregon is as well. And how that crunchy liberal image that Oregon has kind of belies some very, very deep and substantial divides that are so deep, in fact, that Republicans are prepared to sort of suspend, you know, the procedures that have been set in place for passing laws rather than kind of negotiate.
You, as someone who lives in Oregon, what are the lessons here for the rest of us?
I would hope that the lesson is that this is not a precedent that should be followed. I would hope that people are alarmed by seeing that this has apparently worked, that by detonating the process, the Republicans have gotten their way in a way that really, I think, is an affront to democracy. I think that other minorities will look at this and say, hey, you know, look what they did. They're facing down a supermajority and they just took their bat and ball and went home, you know, and refused to negotiate, refused to engage. We could do that too. I'm terribly afraid that lesson will be learned and I'm terribly afraid that we'll see this happen again and again in future legislative sessions.
Jason Wilson, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
Jason Wilson is a columnist at The Guardian and a journalist. You can find him on Twitter at Jason_A_W. And that's the show. What Next is hosted by me, Mary Harris, produced by Mary Wilson, Jason DeLeon, and Ethan Brooks. In case you didn't know, What Next is not the only daily podcast Slate puts out there. Every evening, you can also look for The Gist with Mike Pesca. Today, the show is all about baseball, including this little bit of trivia. What do baseball's seventh inning stretch and Handel's Messiah have in common? If you want the answer, you're going to have to click over to his feed right now. We'll be back here tomorrow. Talk to you then.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS, we are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.